Hari Om Sahana Bhavatu Sahana Bhunaktu Sahaveyam Karabhavahai Tejasvina Vahitamastama Vidvesha Shri Advaita Gadadhara Shiva Sadi Gaura Bhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare
When David first came to the Bowery, he appeared like a clean-cut college student. He was 21, 6 feet tall, blue-eyed, handsome, and intelligent-looking. Most of his new friends in New York were older and considered him a kid. David's family lived in East Lansing, Michigan, and his mother was paying $100 monthly to sublease the loft. Although he did not have much experience, he had read that a new realm of mind expansion was available through psychedelic drugs, and he was heading fast into the hazardous world of LSD. His meeting with the Swami came at a time of radical change and profoundly affected his life. David, it was a really good relationship I had with the Swami, but I was overwhelmed by the tremendous energy of being that close to him. It spurred my consciousness very fast. Even my dreams at night would be so vivid of Krishna consciousness. I was often sleeping when the Swami was up, because he was up late in the night working on translations. That's probably where a lot of consciousness and dreams just flowed in, because of that deep relationship. It also had to do with studying Sanskrit. There was a lot of immediate impact with the language. The language seemed to have such a strong mystical quality, the way he translated it, word for word. Prabhupada's old friend from uptown, Robert Nelson, continued to visit him on the Bowery. He was impressed by Prabhupada's friendly relationship with David, who he saw was learning many things from the Swami. Mr. Robert bought a small American-made hand organ, similar to an Indian harmonium, and donated it to David for chanting with Prabhupada. At 7 in the morning, Mr. Robert would come by, and after Bhagavatam class, he would talk informally with Prabhupada, telling him his ideas for making records and selling books. He wanted to continue helping the Swami. They would sit in chairs near the front window, and Mr. Robert would listen while Prabhupada talked for hours about Krishna and Lord Chaitanya. New people began coming to see Prabhupada on the Bowery. Carl Jurgens, a 36-year-old black man from the Bronx, had attended Cornell University and was now independently studying Indian religion and Zen Buddhism. He had experimented with drugs as psychedelic tools, and he had an interest in the music and poetry of India. He was influential among his friends and tried to interest them in meditation. He had even been dabbling in Sanskrit. What's dabbling?
It's kind of like lightly going through it.
Yeah, yeah, dabbling, just trying, you know, just not getting, you know, poking your finger, but not getting too wet, you know, like that. You know, interested, you know, just trying out different things. Carl, I had just finished reading a book called The Wonder That Was India. I had gotten the definition of a sannyasi and a brahmachari, and so forth. There was a vivid description in that particular book of how you could see a sannyasi coming down the road with a saffron robe. It must have made more than just a superficial impression on me, because it came to me this one chilly evening. I was going to visit Michael Grant, probably going to smoke some marijuana and sit around, maybe play some music. And I was coming down Hester Street. If you made a left on Bowery, you can go up to Mike's place on Grand Street. But it's funny that I chose to go that way, because the shorter way would have been to go down Grand Street. But if I had gone that way, I would probably have missed the Swami. So I decided to go down Hester and then make a left. All of a sudden, I saw in this dingy alcove a bright saffron robe. As I passed, I saw it was Swami knocking on the door, trying to gain entrance. There were two bums hunched up against the door. It was like a two-part door. One of them was sealed and the other was locked. The two bums were lying on either side of Swami. One of these men had actually expired, which often happened, and you had to call the police or health department to get them. I don't think I saw the men lying in the doorway until I walked up to Swamiji and asked him, "Are you a sannyasi?" And he answered, "Yes." We started this conversation about how he was starting a temple, and he mentioned Lord Chaitanya and the whole thing. He just came out with this flow of strange things to me, right there in the street. But I knew what he was talking about somehow. I had the familiarity of having just read this book and delved into Indian religion. So I knew that this was a momentous occasion for me, and I wanted to help him. We banged on the door, and eventually we got into the loft. He invited me to come to a kirtan, and I came back later that night for my first kirtan. From that point on, it was a fairly regular thing, 3 times a week. At one point, Swamiji asked me to stay with him, and I stayed for about 2 weeks. It was perhaps because of Carl's interest in Sanskrit that Prabhupada began holding Sanskrit classes. Carl and David and a few others would spend hours learning Sanskrit under Prabhupada's guidance. Using a chalkboard he found in the loft, Prabhupada taught the alphabet, and his students wrote their exercises in notebooks. Prabhupada would look over their shoulders to see if they were writing correctly, and would review their pronunciation. His students were not simply learning Sanskrit, but the instructions of Bhagavad Gita. Each day he would give them a verse to copy in the Sanskrit alphabet, Devanagari, and transliterate into the Roman alphabet, and then translate word for word into English. But their interest in Sanskrit waned, and Prabhupada gradually gave up the daily class to spend time working on his own translations of the Srimad Bhagavatam. His new friends may have regarded these lessons as Sanskrit classes, but actually they were bhakti classes. He had not come to America as the ambassador of Sanskrit. His Guru Maharaj had ordered him to teach Krishna consciousness. But since he had found in Carl and some of his friends a desire to investigate Sanskrit, he encouraged it. As a youth, Lord Chaitanya had also started a Sanskrit school with the real purpose of teaching love of Krishna. He would teach in such a way that every word meant Krishna. And when his students objected, he closed the school. Similarly, when Prabhupada found that his students' interest in Sanskrit was transitory, and since he himself had no mission on behalf of Sanskrit linguistics, he gave it up. By the standard of classical Vedic scholars, it takes 10 years for a boy to master Sanskrit grammar. And if one does not start until his late 20s or 30s, it is usually too late. Certainly, none of Swamiji's students were thinking of entering a 10-year concentration in Sanskrit grammar. And even if they were, they would not realize spiritual truth simply by becoming grammarians. Prabhupada thought it better to utilize his own Sanskrit scholarship in translating the verses of Srimad Bhagavatam into English, following the Sanskrit commentaries of the previous authorities. Otherwise, the secrets of Krishna consciousness would remain locked away in the Sanskrit. Teaching Carl Jurgens Devanagari, Sandhi, verb conjugations, and noun declensions was not going to give the people of America transcendental Vedic knowledge. Better that he utilize his proficiency in Sanskrit for translating many volumes of Bhagavatam into English for millions of potential readers. Still with us? Yes. Carol Becker came from an immigrant Catholic background, and she immediately associated with Catholicism the Swami's presence as spiritual authority and his devotional practices of chanting on beads and reciting from Sanskrit scriptures. Sometimes she would accompany Prabhupada to nearby Chinatown, where he would purchase ingredients for his cooking. He would cook daily, and sometimes Carol and others would come by to learn the secrets of cooking for Lord Krishna. Means, because somehow or another, at least in the West, before, where they don't have Indian markets, there's generally always Chinese markets, because the Chinese went to the West much earlier, you know, back in the 1800s, 1900s. And so they have markets, and so they use all these Asian vegetables like that. You can even get Corella and things like that. So if you wanted a variety of vegetables other than just eggplants and tomatoes and potatoes, then you go to these Chinese markets like that. And now also Indian markets are there, so you can get there also. Carol. He used to cook with us in the kitchen, and he was always aware of everyone else's activities in addition to his own cooking. He knew exactly how things should be. He washed everything and made sure everyone did everything correctly. He was a teacher. We used to make chapatis by hand, but then one day he asked me to get a rolling pin. I brought my rolling pin, and he appropriated it. Appropriated means, you know, how you say. It would be established it. What? It's not so much that it's not asking. It's a matter of it's kind of like on higher authority. It's taken away. Like the government comes and appropriates land because there's some higher purpose or something. So he appropriated the rolling pin for use in Krishna's service. Right? Yeah. He put some men on rolling chapatis and supervised them very carefully. I made a chutney for him at home. He always accepted our gifts graciously, although I don't think he ever ate them. Perhaps he was worried we might put in something that wasn't allowed in his diet. He used to take things from me and put them in the cupboard. I don't know what he finally did with them, but I am sure he didn't throw them away. I never saw him eat anything that I had prepared, although he accepted everything. Prabhupada held his evening meetings on Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, just as he had uptown. The loft was out of the way for most of his acquaintances, and it was on the Bowery. A cluster of sleeping derelicts regularly blocked the street-level entrance, and visitors would find as many as half a dozen bums to step over before climbing the four flights of stairs. But it was something new. You could go and sit with a group of hip people and watch the Swami lead kirtan. The room was dimly lit, and Prabhupada would burn incense. Many casual visitors came and went. One of them, Gunther, had vivid impressions. So it's like Krishna consciousness is so unique, and at the same time it's so universal, so that it's attractive to anyone if it's presented in its natural form. Right? Sometimes we try to get away from its natural form, trying to make it more Western. But the point is the Westerners, you know, are looking for something different than what they already have. Because what they have is not that developed. It's kind of boring, right? Okay, nice, bright, shiny mall and that. But other than that, pretty boring, right? So, therefore, all the Eastern things, the more exotic, the nice lighting, you know, the incense, the kirtan, the clothes, you know, the Sanskrit, all these different things, they're very, very exotic, very unique, very different. So that's what becomes the special. Otherwise, why do people go to the yoga centers and do all these different things? Because they're different. Right? Does that make sense? So that's the whole point, is one doesn't have to change Krishna consciousness. You just have to present it in a very cultured way, very sophisticated way, very nice, very pure. That will attract people. Right? If you present it through its natural good qualities, you know, then it will be very good. No? It'll be good or won't be good? Should be good. Yeah? So you think it would be better with the chutney or with the, you know, just on its own?
On its own.
On its own. Okay. So then it will be on its own. So nothing added, right? So just straight Krishna consciousness. Okay. Yes? No? Maybe? Okay. One of them, Gunther, had vivid impressions. Gunther, you walked right off the Bowery into a room filled with incense. It was quiet. Everyone was talking in hushed tones, not really talking at all. Swamiji was sitting in front of the room and in meditation. There was a tremendous feeling of peace, which I have never had before. I happened to have studied for 2 years to become a minister and was into meditation, study, and prayer. But this was my first time to do anything Eastern or Hindu. There were lots of pillows around and mats on the floor for people to sit on. I don't think there were any pictures or statues. It was just Swamiji, incense, and mats. And obviously the respect of the people in the room was for him. Before we went up, Carl was laughing and saying how Swami wanted everyone to use the hand symbols just correctly. I had never played the symbols before, but when it began, I just tried to follow Swamiji, who was doing it in a certain way. Things were building up, the sound was building up, and then someone was doing it wrong. And Swamiji just very, very calmly shook a finger at someone and they looked, and then everything stopped. He instructed this person from a distance, and this fellow got the right idea, and they started up again. After a few minutes, the sound of the cymbals and the incense. We weren't in the Bowery any longer. We started chanting Hare Krishna. That was my first experience in chanting. I'd never chanted before. There was nothing in Protestant religion that comes even close to that. Maybe Catholics with their Hail Marys. But it's not quite the same thing. It was relaxing and very interesting to be able to chant. And I found Swami very fascinating. Right? So you have Catholicism, which is like the Western, the, you know, you're kind of like original Western, Catholic, Christian religion, right? And then the church split into two. So then the other side, you had the East Orthodox, which would be out of Turkey and those places. And so they developed their own, you know, specific ways of ritual and everything like that. So one of them you mentioned here, Hail Marys, it's their japa, right? They have their little beads and all that, and they chant this mantra, something like Hail Mary, full of grace, something like that. It keeps going. And so they chant rounds of that, you know. That. So he says that, so the Protestant was, because the Catholicism had become so kind of ritualistic in that, and had even become, you know, in some perceptions even quite materialistic in the way of fundraising and other things like that. So then they, many felt that there was compromise, so they wanted to reform the church. So then they were protesting against, you know, what was going on in the church. So they became the Protestants, right? The Protestants, right? So then slowly, slowly people liked what they were saying. And basically over hundreds of years, I think, because it took that long. Then they became established as their own religion. So they broke off from the Catholic Church. So they weren't just simply correcting any wrongs that they felt. They naturally, like any conditioned endeavor, there's always the tendency to go too much the other way. Does that make sense? So basically what happens, they threw out the authority of the Catholic Church. So the concept of authority was thrown out. And then with that also, all the fine points, you know, so they're like things like chanting, music, art, you know, so many fine things. So the architecture of the buildings is very plain. There's no artwork.
There's no finity at all. It's just supposed to be, you know, you and God and the mood between you and God. There's no medium for that, right? You don't express your affection through God through anything fine. It's just supposed to be just direct sentiment. So then he's pointing out is that this kind of peacefulness and these other things and all these little trappings, they're not present in the Protestant religion, right? Because he was studying to be a minister. He said maybe in the Catholic, in Catholicism, right? But not in the Protestantism, right? So he was just saying that this is something very new, very unique. Yes?
The loft was more open than Prabhupada's previous place uptown, so there was less privacy. And here some of the visitors were skeptical and even challenging. But everyone found him confident and joyful. He seemed to have far-reaching plans. He had dedication. He knew what he wanted to do and was single-handedly carrying it out. Quote, It is not one man's job, end quote, he had said. But he went on doing all he could, depending on Krishna for the results. David was beginning to help, and more people were coming to visit him. Almost all of Prabhupada's Bowery friends were musicians or friends of musicians. They were into music, drugs, women, and spiritual meditation. Because Prabhupada's presentation of the Hare Krishna mantra was both musical and meditative, they were automatically interested. Prabhupada stressed that the Vedic mantras, or hymns, were sung. In fact, the words Bhagavad Gita meant the song of God. But the words of the Vedic hymns were incarnations of God in the form of transcendental sound. The musical accompaniment of hand cymbals, drum, and harmonium was just that, an accompaniment, and had no spiritual purpose independent of the chanting of the name of God. Prabhupada allowed any instrument to be used as long as it did not distract from the chanting. Carl. It was a very interracial, music-oriented scene. There are a few professional musicians and a lot of people who enjoyed playing or just listening. Some people were painting in some of the lofts, and that's basically what was going on. We had memorable kirtans. One time there was a beautiful ceremony. Some of us went over early to prepare for it. There must have been 100 people who came that day. For the Bowery crowd, sound was spirit, and spirit was sound. In emerging of music and meditation. But for Prabhupada, music without the name of God wasn't meditation. It was sense gratification. Or at most, a kind of stylized and personal meditation, right? Because all these people there, these hippies and that, they were into experience. What was the experience? What would it feel like? So meditation, you know, made things peaceful in the mind, because otherwise, you know, the modern contemporary world is very busy with passion and ignorance, so that meditation would introduce a little bit of goodness, so that would make them feel nice. Music then is always a nice thing. You can express yourself. So many experiences can be there in the way of emotions. So these things were very interesting to them. So here's a combination between music and meditation. So this is something new, because they'd do music and they'd have meditation. But this was the combination, so that it was very attractive to them. But for them, it was the music and meditation. And then it was unique than other things because of its spiritual significance. For Prabhupada, it was the other way around. The holy name is what was important, and the music and the other things were added on to it, right? Because otherwise, on their own, what's the big deal, right? You meditate for 5 minutes, feel a little peaceful, and then go back to doing nonsense. So, you know, what's the real benefit? But he was glad to see the musicians coming to play along with his kirtans, to hear him and to chant responsively. Some, having stayed up all night playing somewhere on their instruments, would come by in the morning and sing with the Swami. He did not dissuade them from their focus on sound. Rather, he gave them sound. In the Vedas, sound is said to be the first element of material creation. The source of sound is God, and God is eternally a person. God's emphasis was on getting people to chant God's person, to chant God's personal transcendental name. Whether they took it as jazz, folk music, rock, or Indian meditation made no difference, as long as they began to chant Hare Krishna. Right? So Prabhupada's interest is in the chanting. Is that they're having, you know, they're into the music and they chant along with it and that, but they're getting a special experience that never came. Otherwise, why is like 100 people coming to this? Right? But at the same time, as you know, they were just getting into the whole scene. But for Prabhupada, is they liked sound. But sound is the origin of the creation. Sound is coming from Krishna, right? So if you're dealing with it, so it's not a problem to be into sound. Sound. The sound, though, should be connected to Krishna. So by chanting Krishna's name, then that is connected. So then they're all very, very satisfied, right? Does that make sense? So it's not a matter of their attachment. There's nonsense. Their attachment makes them come and chant Hare Krishna. So in that way, the attachment's not a problem. But by chanting, that attachment will become purified. So the attachment, the sound will remain, but that sound now will be Krishna's name, rather than sound just being anything. Does that make sense? So as they go, they'll become attached to kirtan. And then their attachment to other forms of sound will go away. Yeah? That's the blessing of dovetailing, is that you take something that you like to do, you're going to do it anyway, and then connect that to Krishna. Then by doing that, you're spiritually advancing. You're becoming purified of the attachment to do that thing separately from the Lord, until you are doing the same activity, but now it's always connected to the Lord, so it's no longer mundane. Right? So the activity became purified. Yeah? No? Maybe? Kind of? Ah, we got one nod. There is some life. Carol. Whenever he had the chanting, the people were fairly in awe of the Swami. On the Bowery, a kind of transcendence came out of the ringing of the cymbals. He used the harmonium, and many people played hand cymbals. Sometimes he played the drum. In the very beginning, he stressed the importance of sound, and that the realization of Godhead through sound. That was, I suppose, the attraction that these musicians found in him. The emphasis on sound is a mean to obtaining transcendence and the Godhead. But he wanted a serious thing. He was interested in discipleship. One serious newcomer was Michael Grant. Mike was 24. His father, who was Jewish, owned a record shop in Portland, Oregon, where Mike grew up. After studying music at Portland's Reed College and at San Francisco State, Mike, who played the piano and many other instruments, moved to New York City, along with his girlfriend, hoping to get into music professionally. But he quickly became disenchanted with the commercial musical scene. Playing in nightclubs and pandering to commercial demands seemed particularly unappealing. Right? Because they want to get into music, but the point is why do you get into music? Right? Because they'll get paid for it, right? And so the point is why do people pay for the music? They like it, but specifically
they want you to play what they want to hear.
Yes, they want you to play what they want to hear. So many times they appreciate music, but they don't necessarily know much music. And so therefore what they appreciate may not be very developed. So you have someone who's trained in music, then they have to drop their standards and just, you know, that's the meaning of pandering. Pandering is you just have to do what the other person wants, like that. So this way then they become disenchanted because they've learned this music to do something and express themselves. And then in this environment, they can't really express themselves. They just have to play what the people like so that they get paid. Right? So this way then, if they have some idealism, then they kind of lose interest, you know? Of course, they can do it as a job and then have, you know, what they do in their spare time to do that. But in the Vedic system, you'd be playing for the deities, So then that itself, that devotional interaction, is one's satisfaction, right? So then if one also then has to do this as a job, it doesn't matter, because one can express oneself fully, you know, in one's music when one's playing for the deity.
In New York, he joined the musicians' union and worked as a musical arranger and as an agent for several local groups. Mike lived on the Bowery in an AIR loft on Grand Street. It was a large loft where musicians often congregated for jam sessions. What's a jam session? They all get together and each one has a bottle of strawberry jam or something, and they all eat jam. That's a jam session, right? Yes?
They all play together?
Yes, yes. It just means they just get together and start playing. So it's not necessarily is that, I mean, it can be, it's a specific thing, but they just play. You know, somebody starts something and everybody else adds in and all this, and then they just see where it goes. So it's just for the expression and experience. It's not that it's a specific song. So that's just jamming. I guess because it's, I don't know why it's called jam, because it's all mush or something. No idea. But as he turned more and more to serious composing, he found himself retiring from the social side of the music scene. His interest ran more to the spiritual, quasi-spiritual, and mystical books he had been reading. What is quasi-spiritual? No? Something to do with Kasturba? Because they call him Kazi. So that's quasi spiritual. Or it means when the quasi up in Bamanbankor becomes spiritual, then that's quasi spiritual, right? Before he wasn't so spiritual, then Lord Chaitanya came and talked to him and converted him, so then he became quasi spiritual. Like that? Or are we meaning that quasis are magistrates like this? They're the, you know, Muslim managers, social, I mean, what do you call, you know, of the government managers. So when the government becomes spiritual, that's quasi-spiritual. What do you think? No idea. So quasi-spiritual, quasi means so-called. You know, it seems to be spiritual, but it's not actually. It's got some other kind of purpose to it. You know, it may use the externals of spiritual, but the actual mood of spiritual is not there. Does that make sense? Does that make sense? You know, it's like you see, you know, the brahmachari's got his fancy dhoti, he's got, you know, his little bit of hair there, you know, he's like, you know, the sika, you know, you don't tie it tight, you tie it really long so it moves around when you chant and stuff like that. And then put on some, you know, fancy borders, fancy chudder, you know, always that, you know, some kind of things on the wrist and all that. And does that make some sense? So that's quasi-spiritual. It looks spiritual, but it not necessarily has anything to do with spiritual. Yes? No? See? Oh, he blinked. He just said, I just thought maybe he was asleep while he was sitting there. Okay. He had encountered several swamis, yogis, and self-stylized spiritualists in the city and had taken up hatha yoga. What is a self-stylized spiritualist? Yeah, yeah, you have your own style, right? You just take something, put it together, this, that. I mean, in other words, what they do is they would find the things that the Westerners would like, or whatever group was their audience, or whatever they'd like, and they emphasize those and make that look like that's the important thing. You know, so if they liked incense, oh, you have to have incense. Without incense, then the meditation isn't deep enough, you know, because then, you know, you get distracted. You know, like that, they'll come up with all this kind of nonsense. You know what I'm saying? Like that. From his first meeting with the Swami, Mike was interested and quite open, and he was with all religious persons, as he was with all religious persons. He thought all genuinely religious persons were people were good, although he did not care to identify with any particular group. Mike. There was a little bit of familiarity because I had seen other swamis. The way he was dressed, the way he looked, older and swarthy, weren't new to me. What's swarthy?
Like dark skin?
Yes, kind of like dark skin, like you find all that. Generally those from the, like the, that are all along the tropics, you know? Like that, the skin is a little darker, like around the Mediterranean or India or like this. So it's that slightly more olive-colored skin. So that would be swarthy. But at the same time, there was an element of novelty. I was curious. I didn't hear him talk when I first came in. He was chanting. But mainly I was waiting to hear what he was going to say. I had already heard people chant before. I thought, why else would he put himself in such a place without any comforts, unless the message he's trying to get across is more important than his own comfort? I think the thing that struck me the most was the poverty that was all around him. This was curious, because the places that I have been before had been just the opposite, very opulent. There was a Vedanta center in Upper Manhattan and others. They were filled with staid, older men with their leather chairs and pipe tobacco, that kind of environment. But this was real poverty. The whole thing was curious. So what is that? So he's pointing out that he had been in contact with all this, you know, Eastern kind of religion and stuff before, but it was always very opulent. All these, you know, if you're staid elder gentlemen, you know, kind of like stuffy old, you know, very conservative persons who had this interest in philosophy or that. So they'd sit around and discuss that. It didn't change their lifestyle. You know, that's why it's all the leather chairs and their tobacco and this and that. So they'd follow the, it's as if they were sitting in their own, you know, how you say, drawing room or their own place like that with a few close friends and sitting around and discussing some philosophy or stuff like that. So they'd set up a club where there's more chairs and more space for people to smoke their pipes and stuff like that, right? Because in their own den, then maybe only, you know, two or three could sit, you know, because it was more small. But here, then they have a big place like that. So it's the same thing. Or the swamis would come along and, you know, the yoga studios, and they'd catch these more rich, wealthy persons and get them interested. They would give money. They'd keep the place really nice looking and all that. So they would be comfortable because of the material surroundings. And then the whatever they were discussing philosophically, that would be of interest. You understand? So the comfort was the physical surroundings were what they're used to. You know, maybe add a few little bit of exotic things to it, but that was quite common, actually, in certain levels of society. You know, since possibly back in the 1800s, you know, right on through, that there were certain social groups that would, you know, dabble, as we said, into the Eastern, you know, the Oriental kind of exotics. And so then they would, you know, little things like, you know, incense or music or, you know, some kind of paintings or statues. That's what he said. He came in. There's no paintings and no statues because everywhere else you go, there'll be some variety of Oriental painting or statue, you know, something there that around to create some little, you know, environment like that. But it was just that. It was just that opulence. It didn't have that life. But here, the attractiveness was the actual spirituality, the mood of it. That was what struck people. Because they had seen all these other swamis. It was nice, and they didn't know any different, so it was like how they lived, and so it fit. But now they're finding something very different, something very unique, that the message is what is important, and the medium is only important in as much as it gives you the, you know, the how do you say, the import, the Krishna consciousness. Yes? No? Did you understand what I just said? Yes? No? Maybe? Do you understand English? We seem to be getting no response here. But the words were okay? Yeah? Okay. The Swami looked very refined, which was also curious that he was in this place, right? Because he's very refined, but he's in a situation of extreme poverty. So that generally, people that are in poverty are very unrefined, you know, dirty, unkept, not dressed well. You know, their movements are not refined or developed. But here is somebody very refined, clean, you know, cultured, but in a situation where it's poverty. So only the Vedic culture will give you that. You have, because the renounced orders, they're sophisticated, but they just don't live in opulence, right? And then those within opulence, it's also sophisticated. So the whole Vedic culture is very refined, right? But at the same time, very simple. So the mood is very simple and nice, but very sophisticated. When he talked, I immediately saw that he was a scholar, and he spoke with great conviction. Some statements he made were very daring. He was talking about God, and this was all new, to hear someone talk about God. I always wanted to hear someone I could respect talk about God. I always liked to hear religious speakers, but I measured them very carefully. When he spoke, I began to think, well, here is someone talking about God who may really have some realization of God. He was the first one I had come across who might be a person of God, who could feel real deeply. Prabhupada is lecturing. So this is from the lecture. Sri Krishna is just trying to place Arjuna on the platform of working in pure consciousness. We have already discussed for so many days that we are not this dull body, but we are consciousness. Somehow or another, we are in contact with matter. Therefore, our freedom is checked. Attendance is better now than it had been uptown. The loft offers a larger space. In fact, the platform where Prabhupada sits nearly equals the entire area of his entire office cubicle on 72nd Street. The dingy loft with its unpainted rafters is more like an old warehouse than a temple. The members of his audience, most of them musicians, have come to meditate on the mystical sounds of the Swami's kirtan. Carol, Gunther, Mike, David, the crowd from the Paradox, and others joining him on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night, when he holds classes beginning punctually at 8 o'clock. The program consists of half an hour of chanting Hare Krishna, followed by a lecture from Bhagavad Gita, usually 45 minutes long, then a question and answer period, and finally another half hour of chanting. Everything ended by 10. So that means question and answer was like 15 minutes. The kirtan had just ended, and Swamiji is speaking. So he does an hour of kirtan, 45 minutes of lecture, and 15 minutes of question and answer. So 1 hour of philosophy, 1 hour of kirtan. Right? So then that seems to work. Too much philosophy, then, you know, doesn't get, you know, they won't be so interested, and too much, and if it's just kirtan, then they will never learn the philosophy, so it'll just be sentiment. So you find a balance so that they are attracted by the kirtan, but at the same time they learn something. So they're actually acting out of knowledge rather than just sentiment. Yes? No? Maybe? Yeah? The kirtan has just ended and Swamiji is speaking. As spiritual beings we are free to act, free to have anything. Pure, no contamination, no disease, no birth, no death, no old age. And besides that, we have got many, many other qualifications in our spiritual life. When he speaks, he is pure spiritual form. The Vedic scriptures say that a sadhu, a saint, is not seen but heard. If people in the audience want to know Swamiji, they will have to hear him. He is no longer simply the old Indian immigrant who lives on the other side of the partition of this loft, hanging his clothes to dry, barely getting his meals. But now he is speaking as the emissary of Lord Krishna, beyond time and space, and hundreds of spiritual masters in the chain of disciplic succession are speaking through him. He has entered amid New York's bohemians in 1966, saying that 1966 is temporary and illusory, that he is eternal and they are eternal. This was the meaning of the kirtan, and now he is explaining it philosophically, advocating a total change in consciousness, yet knowing they can't take it all. He urges them to take whatever they can. Right? Bohemians. What is a bohemian? Bohemian is a very interesting category of people. See, in Europe, there's this place called Bohemia. It is in the Czech Republic. And it's on the western, most western side of the Czech Republic. So over there, the people somehow or another naturally are very intellectual. Right? They like to sit around and, speculate on various aspects that they would consider to be philosophical. So, you know, the lifestyle is very simple. You do whatever you like. It's all on the mental platform, like that. Very intellectual, very mental, you know, very free. You know, they don't like to be constrained by, norms and everything. But the interesting thing is I don't know what they wear now, but the last time I was there, that was like back in the 90s, like 95, 96 or something. Then they all had their little berets, they all had the little goatees, they all had the same kind of dark outfits. So they all look exactly the same, but they were not conforming with regular society, so that way they made them different. So this concept, this bohemian kind of thing came to the West. That had been, you know, a long time, but it was specifically there. So the bohemians, they became the hippies, basically. They morphed into the hippies. At least the younger people did, like that. I guess the older people stayed bohemians, like that. But, you know, philosophy, music, you know, not being, not worrying about social norms and everything, you know, just doing whatever they liked. That was kind of it. We leave something out. Okay. But it's standard in Czech. Just somehow or other that got caught interest, and then it became, you went to the West, you know. So then, you know, like that. But otherwise it wasn't that they created in the West. It was homegrown, you know, from Czechoslovakia. No, from Czech. Well, then it was Czechoslovakia, but I don't know if the Slovakians have much to do with it. I think they're not quite... They're not as intellectually...
They're mostly farmers.
Yes, they're farmers. Yeah. Okay. Okay, we're over the time. Okay, so it's indeed the... continue tomorrow.
Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare.
Jai Srila Prabhupada ki.
Jai.